Today on the 21st, Chicago filmmaker Dinesh Sebu's parents died when he was six. More than two decades later, he's trying to figure out who they were and what happened.
In the years after their deaths, it was just too raw an experience. I think it would have just been too painful to really talk about. So the silence is kind of how we coped. But the weight of that silence got heavier and heavier as we grew older.
We'll talk with Dinesh about the story of how mental illness affected his family. It's part of a new Kartemquin documentary film called Unbroken Glass. But first, we've heard about Governor Rauner's turnaround agenda. Now, state Democrats are pushing a comeback agenda, but will either of them ever agree on a budget? Plus, Governor Rauner's feud with Comptroller Susana Mendoza. We bring you the latest in Illinois politics with Chicago Tribune reporter Monique Garcia and Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their weekend. Special thanks to Brian Moline and Scott Cameron for filling in for me while I was away. Today on the program, we're going to be talking with Chicago filmmaker Dinesh Sebu about his new Kartemquin film, Unbroken Glass. But first, like we do every Monday, we're bringing you the latest in Illinois politics with two political reporters who are helping us go beyond the headlines. Joining us now from the state capitol in Springfield is Monique Garcia, State House Bureau reporter for the Chicago Tribune, along with Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey. Monique, Brian, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
How you doing?
Brian, let's start with you. Last week on the program, we talked a little bit about next year's governor's race. It turns out now there won't be any financial limits on how much candidates can spend. How does that happen? Can you remind us of this kind of weird law for financing and what that means for Illinois voters?
Yeah, you could think of it as like a pressure relief valve. Legislators, they're always interested in their own reelection, and so they put in a protection to the campaign finance law. Illinois still does restrict the amount of money you can donate to candidates, but they say if you have one person in the race who's really wealthy and decides to self-fund above a certain threshold, which I believe is $250,000, then the caps come off. I think given that Governor Rauner, who is a many hundred millionaire many times over, it was just a question of when, not if, the caps were going to be busted. Of course, he donated $50 million to his campaign fund, but did so at the very tail end of last year, which meant that for this new election cycle heading into 2018, those caps would remain in place. But now Chris Kennedy made a donation to his campaign that finally take the limits off.
Yeah, Monique, when we think about this, we think about how expensive the races were, how much more money was spent in Illinois. I'm thinking about during the last election cycle compared to other typical state races. Do you sort of see this just the ante just continuing to up in Illinois?
I think that's been made very clear. The governor has indicated that he is willing to spend at least $50 million and likely more, especially coming from his allies. So you've really seen a conversation among Democrats where they're trying to figure out how best to counter that money. So you see two people who have announced their intentions to run on the Democratic side, Chris Kennedy, who has a lot of money. They have a lot of money. And so the question has become, as Democrats, do we need to rally around people with big checkbooks, or can we offer a message that counters the governor's money without putting this much money into the race as well?
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of money, let's talk about who's not getting money, which is the state of Illinois not having a budget. Monique, last week you reported late last week about credit ratings agencies again trying to sound the alarm over the long-term damage this basically standoff we've been in for how many months long at this point. Monique, can you just talk about the credit rating agencies at this point and kind of where you think their frustration level is or what we're hearing from them, which is a little unusual from a credit rating agency?
Sure. So the credit rating agencies for months have been warning that without action, they will downgrade Illinois' credit rating. That is notable because the state already is ranked lowest in the nation for its credit rating. And so that it costs more for the state to borrow. And most governments operate where they borrow some money for certain programs to kind of fill in the gaps. But they've really sounded the alarm lately because they've made it clear that this is a problem that is political, that this is not about the state's lack of ability to have a good economy to pay for things, but it's simply an unwillingness of the governor and lawmakers to work together to find a solution. And they note that, you know, things are getting to a point where it's becoming unsustainable. And so far, the state has been able to pay back its debt, but they worry that the longer that we go, we cannot afford to pay for our operating costs, and we're going to start dipping into those reserves that you'd normally set aside for debt payments, and that's going to really cause havoc when it comes to the state's bond rating and also just how it's generally perceived on Wall Street.
Go ahead, Brian.
Just add to that. I mean, and they emphasize, and to emphasize a point Monique was making, that this is really a political fight. Illinois is going through the sort of budgetary problems that you would expect to see if there was a recession. But this is a completely man-made crisis. And they emphasize that point, and it's completely in the power of the people who are in charge to resolve this if they want to. There is just not the political will to do what needs to be done.
Right. And if you ask the governor about this, who, as he was campaigning against Democrat Pat Quinn, he repeatedly said, this is horrible. Our credit ratings are going in the tank. We have to do something. You ask him now and he just says, oh, well, you know, the credit rating agencies, they just want you to raise taxes and they don't really, really care about what that means for your pocketbook long term. So he doesn't really seem all that concerned because he thinks that this is a giant conspiracy to raise taxes, which he doesn't want to do on his own. He says he's open to tax increase, but he wants it to come with these political reforms that he's pushing to help businesses.
Yeah, political and economic reforms. And the rating agencies, as he points out, don't really care about that. They just say you need to cut spending and raise revenue and fix the budget problems, which, frankly, is a message that tracks more with what the Democrats have been saying this whole time. I mean, they're not as interested in these economic and political changes the governor wants to push through either.
Well, and we've heard, of course, him call this the turnaround agenda. Brian, you mentioned Senate Democrats. They're coming up with their own agenda. They're calling the comeback agenda. What's the point of that?
Yeah, this is not just Senate Democrats. It's House and Senate Democrats. Mm-hmm. They say they're a rank and file group that came together to sort of counter what the governor has been saying. We've often heard Governor Rauner say, look, I know it doesn't have to be my ideas for improving Illinois' economy. I just want to hear any ideas. And I guess Democrats are perhaps saying, let's see how that works out now that we're going to put forth our ideas. Frankly, what they came out with are things we've heard before, changing the Illinois Constitution to require or to take off the provision that says we have to have a flat tax and allowing them to put in a graduated or progressive income tax, which basically means people at the top end of the income scale pay higher tax rates. There are things in there about changing the way legislative maps are drawn, raising the minimum wage, which is, of course, a very popular issue among Democratic voters. It was really only five pieces of legislation, and they had already been working their way through the process. 20 additional bullet points that have not yet really been necessarily been put into bill form. Nothing particularly new on the Democratic side, but I guess what is new is that they are standing together and trying to put a branding on it, if you will.
Yeah, and you know, that's Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey, Chicago Tribune's Monique Garcia. Both of them are with us live from the State House in Springfield. Monique, to Brian's point about branding, as we're talking about the kind of public pressure that needs to be put on elected officials, I want to get to situations and thinking about what's happening at Southern Illinois University in just a minute. But how much of this is marketing and branding war to try to maybe, I don't know, change people's minds, get people maybe more involved in this process?
I think a lot of this fight has been about the blame game. Who is responsible the most for how horrible the situation is right now? So the governor had his agenda. He could at least point to something he was working towards. Democrats, they didn't really have that. For a lot of the time, they were kind of looking toward leadership and hoping that just their power in the General Assembly would resolve things. That hasn't happened. And as one Democrat said, this plan was really about wanting to be for something, which is not hugely inspiring, given that a lot of it doesn't impact the current budget, and it really doesn't do a lot to move the ball forward. If anything, it kind of shows that they're retreating back into their own camps, where Republicans have one plan, Democrats have another plan, and they're just unwilling to meet in the middle here.
And when we think about that, I'm also thinking about the back and forth, of course, between Governor Rauner and House Speaker Michael Madigan. In particular, last week, a pretty public dispute about the sale of the Thompson Center. Which one of you wants to kind of weigh in and fill us in on what's going on there and a kind of unusual letter that Speaker Madigan released to reporters in this now kind of very public fight going on between the governor and House Speaker Madigan?
Yeah, I mean, this is a fight that's been going on, what, for a couple of years
right
now? And it's convenient for the you know, it's a convenient narrative because you have two very powerful people. And of course, it plays into the governor's narrative, who wants people in Illinois to think that Speaker Madigan is the root of everything that has ever gone wrong in the state of Illinois. And so the governor sort of furthering that message held an event at a Illinois Department of Transportation facility to complain that the speaker was blocking his attempt to privatize toll lanes on Interstate 55. Instead of having the government expand Interstate 55, as has happened in the past in Illinois, he would work with a private company to put in lanes that would have variable pricing. So if there was a lot of traffic and you have enough disposable income that you want to pay a little more to get in that carpool or, you know, that free lane on the side there, you could do that. And then he also sort of, in the course of that, complained that the speaker was also blocking the sale of the James R. Thompson Center, that big glass building that people love to complain about in downtown Chicago. I should say people who work there like to complain about it.
A lot of people like to complain about that building.
Yeah, I mean,
people
Monique
who go there complain about it,
too. She can talk
I
about that.
There
she used to work
years.
There. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
awful.
Yeah.
There are cockroaches. It's horrible.
Yeah. So anyways, the governor wants to sell that. He says the speaker's blocking it. The speaker releases a uncharacteristically public and snarky letter for him, saying, you know, it's disingenuous of you. It's beneath your office to make false statements. And he says that as the governor was holding that news conference at that very moment, his staff and the governor's staff were having what the speaker described as a productive meeting. And this is just kind of goes to what, you know, the governor's message is. This is easy. People want these things. Let's just get her done. Fix it. That's kind of the governor's message. And the speaker says, well, there's all these technical issues that we have to look at, like zoning in the city. And there's literally a CTA station in the building. And so we have to figure out, we can't just, you know, sell it on eBay and let somebody take. I mean, there's all these like details that have to be worked out. And so this kind of goes to the heart of, you know, the governor has a message he wants to get out there, and it's, you know, trying to appeal to voters and says, you know, let's just fix things. Let's get things done. The speaker comes in and says, whoa, it's not that easy. We have all these technical things we have to deal with. And, you know, it plays right into this message of he said this, he said that, blah, blah, blah. And yet Illinois continues on 642 days right now without a budget.
And speaking of that, Governor Rauner was on WGN Radio last week, Steve Cochran's show. And there was sort of another public dispute going on now between Comptroller Mendoza, Comptroller Susana Mendoza, and Governor Rauner over a joke that was made about her. Monique, can you tell us what happened there?
Sure. So the governor last week came out with a series of ads in which he's kind of peeling duct tape off of the camera. And the duct tape is supposed to signify these kind of makeshift fixes that the Democrats have put together on the budget. He's on this talk show and they're kind of complaining about Susana Mendoza, and the governor's saying, you know, she's in cahoots with Speaker Madigan. She's blocking my efforts on certain things, and this is all a conspiracy. And at one point, Steve Cochran suggests, well, maybe we could put duct tape over her mouth. And so it's debatable, depending on if you listen to it, because the governor's calling in to the radio show, so it's not very clear. But it sounds like either he coughs or he makes a laugh. Comptroller Mendoza equated that to a laugh and then held a press conference on Friday, the last day of Women's History Month, and said that this is a conversation that we need to be talking about because it represents rape culture and him suggesting that he wants to silence me. She had advocates there for different social service providers who've lost funding throughout the budget impasse for sexual assault victims and things of that nature, and really called on him and called on the radio host to apologize. And the governor's office did not answer directly. They actually referred calls to the Illinois Republican Party, who said that, you know, this is ludicrous, this is out of bounds, and he did not laugh. But then this morning, Steve Cochran, who did issue an apology after this happened, this press conference happened, he said, you know, I believe that this was about politics for Susana Mendoza. If she really had an issue, she could have called me. He said that he had, he grew up in a home that had abuse, and this is no laughing matter for him, but that if this was something that really bothered her, she should have called him instead of having a press conference to get political gain.
And while all this is going on, I want to go back to what I mentioned earlier, Southern Illinois University President Randy Dunn proposing a short-term financial emergency declaration suggesting roughly $30 million in cuts that would slash SIU's entire travel budget immediately, leave 158 positions unfilled. All of this as the ongoing budget impasse is really not just, as you mentioned, Monique, social service agencies, public universities. Do you guys sort of see this as the new normal?
I mean, it has become the new normal, and polling suggests that certainly the residents of Illinois think so. I think people here have been hearing about how terrible state government is for so long that these stories, I don't know that they really penetrate the consciousness of voters. Polling says that two-thirds of Illinoisans still are not affected by the impasse, and I think that, you know, it's just one story after another. And as Monique pointed out earlier, the governor's out there with his ads, you know, paying with it, where he's going to be in a flannel shirt saying, I just want to fix things. It certainly does not suggest that that there's going to be any sort of popular uprising to force action in Springfield.
For a long time, the question has been, at what point does the pressure become so much that there has to be action? And we continually just haven't gotten there. And so you really have to wonder how bad things have to get. We were talking to some Democrats last week after they unveiled their agenda. And we said, what happens? I mean, at what point does something give? And there's a suggestion that maybe it has to come to a point where you're impacting K through 12 schools.
Right.
They've operated largely without disruption. There have been some money flow issues, but they've been open because Democrats and Republicans have agreed that that so far has been the sacred cow. That might change as this battle intensifies and as both sides right now acknowledge there might not be a full budget for the next 2 years.
This is Chicago Tribune's Monique Garcia. I want to thank Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey for joining us as well. Coming up, Dinesh Sabu, a documentary filmmaker on his new film that's being screened this week in Peoria, Unbroken Glass. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Schizophrenia. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was my mother. Was it the way she left me in front of the TV for hours while she zoned out? Was it the time she explained to me that we're all being watched? Or was it the old piano that she randomly found and began practicing?
This project is very much born out of just my curiosity about them.
That's a clip from the new documentary film, Unbroken Glass. It's a story of one Indian family and filmmaker Dinesh Sabu's mom, who committed suicide a month after his father died from cancer. Dinesh and his two younger brothers were raised by their two older siblings, and as an adult, he explores his family story in this deeply personal film. He's in studio with me in Urbana now. Hey, Dinesh, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by just asking about your mom. In the beginning of the film, she looks so glamorous. She's right. Beautiful. She's got these super cool Western clothes on.
Yeah.
You know, not maybe exactly what you, or at least what I would think of a typical Indian immigrant to the U.S. in the 70s or in the 80s. What do you remember about your mom?
You know, she was an incredibly creative person. And I think that speaks to that sense of style that she had. You know, I was six when she passed away, so I just have, you know, a handful of real memories with her. But, you know, a big part of my understanding of her was this really brilliant, very just creative, warm, nurturing person. This is, of course, before she got ill.
And do you remember that? And you talk about this a little bit. Those are sort of your final memories of her, is her being ill.
Right. Well, so I actually only knew her when she was ill. And there were good moments, there were good days, and then there were bad days that she had. So, a lot of my early memories, you know, a lot of that slideshow that I talk about is just her being very unwell.
Mm. And so you were raised by your older sisters after your parents both passed away. How much older were your sisters at that point?
Right. So when I was 6 years old when they passed, and my eldest sister was 21 and my other sister was 15. So, you know, basically still children as well.
Yeah, you guys make this point. This is a great time reference. I think people of a certain age, like you guys were like boxcar kids.
Exactly,
which
yeah.
For everybody who's read those books, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Did it seem, as a kid, and you had family in India that I assume seemed, you know, there's a part towards the end of the film where they talk about the decision the family made
right.
to not take you and your brothers and send them back to India and be raised by extended family because your sisters really wanted, you guys all wanted to stay together.
Yeah, yeah.
So was a kid, did you have extended family around? Were they all in India or what was that interaction like?
They were mostly in India and there was a real disconnect because especially back then, this was before the internet, before making phone calls was really cheap and easy. I don't think they really fully understood what the experience of being American, of growing up as an immigrant in America was like. So in some ways, it made a lot more sense to stay with my sisters because we would remain that family. If I left, if we were taken away, you know, our family really would break up after the deaths of our parents.
And so you talk about at the beginning of the film about how your siblings, how you kind of only get together a couple of times a year. But I wanted to ask, how did they react to when you started this project?
So I'm their baby brother. And when I first had the idea, I pitched it to them. And, you know, I think I sent them some emails and followed up with a phone call. And, you know, they were all like, okay, this, yeah, sure, we'll give it a try. And then, you know, one of the time we got together and I showed up with my camera and they were like, oh, he was serious. Like, this wasn't one of just these ideas that he was talking about. And they went along with it. You know, they kind of indulged me. I think it took a lot to get them comfortable being on camera and being on camera talking about something so personal and so painful.
And this wasn't something you guys talked about as kids growing up. Did you talk about this?
You know, we for the most part, we didn't. The silence was necessary. I think it was a way to survive. In the years after their deaths, I think we it was just too raw an experience. I think it would have just been too painful to really talk about. So the silence is kind of how we coped. But the weight of that silence got heavier and heavier as we grew older. And, you know, we would acknowledge it here and there, but never in a really deliberate, specific way like I did in the film.
And what was the motivation for you when you started working in, when you started doing films? Did you think this is a story that I want to tell?
You know, I was really hesitant, actually. I was worried that there wasn't a way to tell the story without exploiting it, without exploiting my parents and their struggle. And it wasn't until I started collaborating. There's this really excellent group of filmmakers in Chicago called Cartemquin Films. I started there as an intern. And I think when I learned how they were approaching subject matters and how they were telling documentary stories, I realized that there was a way to tell this in a really empowered way. There was a way to tell this that almost celebrated my parents as opposed to exploit the you know, tragic things that happened to them.
And so you do something, Dinesh, you do something really interesting. I'm not sure I've ever seen it before. You say to everybody you talk to, you guys can interview me as well.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
So, you know, early, that was a technique we developed really early on. And a big part of that was realizing that I was just as much a subject as they were, and that the story belonged to them as well. And it was a way for me to kind of get them to buy into the project and get them to feel less like a subject and more like an empowered kind of storyteller. I think it also just diffused some of just the power dynamic, you know, between being behind camera and in front of camera. You know, sitting behind a camera is an incredibly powerful position. And it was uncomfortable subjecting my siblings to something like that without, you know, putting myself to the same scrutiny.
Yeah, I was thinking it is a little like sitting behind a mic,
Exactly, I guess, yeah. Right?
And then there's this remarkable moment in the film where his brother says he wants to ask you questions and you switch places. And he says, it's interesting. Of course, the tone, I'm not going to get the tone of how he says it. He says, you know, it's interesting you want to film this, that it's not about just the parents, but it's about the family. And he tells you that you have to be careful and that there are things that he doesn't want to share. And then he tells you he doesn't want to be interviewed anymore.
Yeah. It was his way to just, it was his way to kind of confront me. I think being behind camera, he felt empowered to kind of say those things. And also, it was a moment where I think as a filmmaker, you know, it's tricky making a personal doc because you're both a filmmaker and you're a subject and you have these relationships. I was also a brother. And so I think I took liberties and maybe was given liberties as a brother that maybe was unfair as a filmmaker. And so I think Sandeep saying that stuff to me, it was his way to kind of rebalance this situation.
And what went through your head when he said that?
I mean, to be honest, in the moment, I was like, man, couldn't you have said this before the interview? Why are you doing this now? But ultimately,
so the brother said that, but the filmmaker put it in the film.
Right. The filmmaker was like, well, this is actually a really great moment where I can show you, the viewer, and you know, how I'm keeping myself accountable. You know, it's really tempting to make, when you're making a documentary, to make yourself look as good as possible, or just edit out any mistake you make. But this is a moment, a really human moment. I make a mistake. My brother holds me accountable, and, you know, I'm sharing it with you, the viewer.
But how do you feel like it was a mistake? You feel like because you were pushing him too much?
I think I was pushing him too much. And I think, you know, he says you have to be careful. And I think that was a big part of it. I think I was expecting a lot from him as a subject that I might not have necessarily earned as a filmmaker.
And so the look on your face, it's interesting you say that, because I feel like the look on, as a viewer, when I look at the expression on your face when he says that, you just look so hurt. In my mind, I was just thinking what was going through your head was, am I really damaging my family by telling this story?
Right. Well, and I think that's, you know, that's definitely part of it as well. I think the fear is, and it harks back to that fear of exploitation that I was talking about earlier, that, oh man, like in crossing that line, am I kind of bringing my family along, you know, as well?
Why did you keep filming then at that point?
Well, I mean, I think it was important, you know, and there were some conversations afterwards where I kind of made clear with Sandeep what I was hoping to do. And he was very, you know, he was actually very gentle about it. He was, you know, it was just his participation that he was going to withdraw. Other siblings, like my sisters, they were still really willing to be part of this journey. And my extended family still understood why it was important for me to go on this journey. And they really wanted to share stories. So, you know, and that's a moment in the film where, you know, my journey kind of branches out from being mostly centered around my siblings and more towards my aunt and my uncles.
Right. And so you have sort of your whole extended family that you talk to. Your aunt says something. Actually, I wanted to play this if we could. She says at one point, this is the moment actually we learn why you named the film Unbroken Glass. Let's hear what your aunt has to say.
So when we see a glass broken, we always think, oh, it's a broken glass, you know? But when you see a beautiful glass or anything, you know exactly how that person was before and what is missing. And it's more hurtful.
That's a clip from Unbroken Glass. It's a documentary film. Filmmaker Dinesh Sebu's in studio with me. This film is actually going to be screened later this week in Peoria, by the way. We will tweet out all the details for that if you follow 21st Show, the time and all of that information. So it's so interesting to hear your family, because you get that your family does run the gamut of different levels of how they processed it or dealt with it or how open they are about talking about it. This aunt, I feel like she really gave you a lot of information. She really spent a lot of time talking to you about your mom and what she was like. And she seems like she's really, really thought about this and processed this a lot herself.
Absolutely. And she's, you know, she's present. She's emotionally present in ways that is really hard for a lot of people to do, to be on camera. You know, When I was showing some of this footage to my collaborators at Cartemwin, you know, we realized really early on that, you know, my Masi, she's kind of the perfect documentary subject. She's really feeling things with you, and she volunteers information. And we just kind of really lucked out in having her, you know, participate like that. Other family members, you're right. I mean, I think everybody grieves in their own way. Everybody kind of has dealt with the events in their own way, and they weren't necessarily as forthcoming, or they were maybe a little more guarded. But I think my Masi, she understood almost immediately why I was doing this and the value in doing it.
And for you, I wonder what it was like, and I'm curious about the process. Cartemquin, Gordon Quinn is one of the producers of this of the film,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Founder of Cartemquin Studios. What was it like for you to kind of work on this as a filmmaker and process all of this with him and with the other folks who do such great work there? I wonder what it was like to have that kind of guidance as you were putting this together.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say it's a very different film than a lot of what Cartemquin would normally take on, but it still kind of fits into this ethos of social change through documentary and really telling stories, the power of storytelling for that kind of change. You know, it was really, it's incredibly vulnerable sharing these very, very intimate moments with coworkers, with collaborators and friends. You know, this is raw footage. This isn't stuff that, you know, I had time to process and put into the, you know, put into an edit like you see in the final film. This is stuff that, you know, I'm still processing myself as a, you know, 26-year-old as I'm making the film. So it took an incredible amount of courage, I should say, just to toot my own horn. But I also think it took an incredible amount of compassion on their part to really understand the value in what I was doing and understand kind of what the footage could become.
How has your family received the film?
So it was really important for me to get my siblings' blessing even before it came out. So when I had a rough cut.
All of them?
Yes, all four of them.
Okay.
So I had a rough cut, like an early draft of the film, and I would sit them down and screen the rough cut, and just have a conversation with them. You know, what did they like? What didn't they like? Did they learn anything? What did I get wrong? Just a really open-ended conversation. And, you know, from there, I was able to take their comments and kind of massage the cut a little bit. Some of the comments I followed, some I kind of respectfully declined. But from there, I think we had a version where they were all pretty happy with. And now that the film's been done and we've been showing it, you know, most of my siblings have had a chance to see it with an audience. And I think they can see just the profound experience it has in just being able to share the story and getting people to talk about these things. That being said, it's still really painful for them to watch. You know, this isn't the kind of film we're going to show, you know, we're going to watch every Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, because I'm sure it's even just really painful when there are scenes where you are also going to find out more about your dad, and you go talk to his dad, your dad's colleagues about what it was like when they found out that he had stomach cancer, and you're just sort of going back and tracing like his final months as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure that was that a painful thing for you, or was that something you found a little more cathartic?
You know, in the moment, it was incredibly painful. And I think what you see there in that scene is some real grieving happening. And it wasn't the kind of thing I realized I needed to do. But it makes perfect sense in hindsight. Of course, you can't take on material like this without doing that emotional work of grieving and understanding loss. But ultimately, it was really cathartic. And it's hard to describe just putting it into a narrative that I can then share with an audience, just how profound that experience actually is.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. I'm talking to Chicagoan Dinesh Sebu. His film is called Unbroken Glass. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Dinesh Sabu. He's a director, a filmmaker. It's a Kontepquin film. He's based in Chicago. It's called Unbroken Glass. It's the story, we've been talking about the story of his family, the story of his mother who committed suicide a month after his father died from cancer. A deeply personal story that I think it's so interesting, Dinesh, of how much there's such a stigma around mental illness, and it doesn't really matter. I think this is something that cuts across all cultures, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so as you've been screening this, I wonder if you get different reactions based on the community, whether you're screening this with Asian American audiences or South Asian audiences or, you know, audiences that are of like lots of different cultures.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting to know, it's interesting to see who makes it to the theater, who actually is interested in this story, and then the kind of conversations they want to have. You know, I was shocked when I thought, when I finished the film, I thought I was going to need to do a lot of work to convince Asian American communities why they would, why this is a useful film, why they would, you know, the virtue of watching something like this. But what I found instead was just a real eagerness to screen the film and have these conversations. People got it almost right away when I would talk to them about it. So, you know, what I've found is this great absence of discussion, this silence. And, you know, the hope is this film can kind of break that silence and start these discussions in communities.
And did you find, obviously, we've been talking about your immediate family, but then this, I feel like there's a sort of an extended conversation and with your extended family where it breaks the silence. And I'm thinking about you talk to your mother's brother, who also has schizophrenia. And then you find out when you're talking to him, when you're talking to your cousin and to his wife, that you find out that your other uncle, your mother's other brother, may have also had schizophrenia. Is that something you found out when you were doing the film?
You know, in that scene, I am learning that for the first time on camera. I'm learning about his suicide attempts and my other uncle's suicide as well.
And so then you realize that three of siblings in this family suffered from mental illness.
Suffered from some kind of mental illness. I mean, at least two had schizophrenia, and all three have either attempted suicide or died by suicide.
And is that something that you feel like, obviously you find out about this from your family. Do you have a sense that this was something, and I think this is true of a lot of families, right? People just wouldn't talk about this stuff.
Right. I mean, I remember going back and talking to my immediate family, my siblings, and they didn't know about some of this stuff either. And, you know, there was just a tremendous amount of silence within our family.
And I think that there's sort of the other half of this, right? Because as you learn this, I think there's a very natural conclusion that anyone thinks when you're talking about mental illness, especially when you're thinking about this being something that has been in your family, you worry also about yourself. And you're very open in the film about your problems with depression. Mm-hmm. How did you sort of cope with all of that too?
I mean, I think in many ways, making the film was my way of really trying to cope. I think I needed to go on this journey to understand more about my mother's life, to understand it in relation to what I was going through. You know, I've dealt with depression for, you know, at this point, 20 years. And, you know, I've come up with ways of managing it. But, you know, as I was making the film, I did have this fear that, you know, schizophrenia might be something that would be in my future. And I remember reading really early, it presents in men by age 27. And so as I was kind of entering my 20s and, you know, making the film and growing up, I really looked at that birthday as a life buoy. Like, if I could just make it to 27, I'll be okay. So, you know, 27 came and went, and, you know, I'm still doing okay. And I'm managing depression as best I can. But I think it was really, I needed to go on this journey to look at these things out in the open and understand fully my own experience and connect all of the context, all of the history, all of the family stuff that goes into, you know, who I am.
Why do you think it's important for families to do this together too?
I mean, I think just on a really practical level, you know, there are decisions you can make in your life that have bearing on your mental health. You know, so I should say schizophrenia has a genetic component, but it also has an environmental component. It's usually triggered by some kind of stress factor. So, you know, we have a predilection. We have the genetic component of schizophrenia in our family. There's no denying it. So my thinking is, what can we do in an empowered way with that knowledge? Are there things we can do to kind of make sure that we mitigate those stress factors, that we understand, just, you know, have a sense of interiority and have a sense of, oh, this is my mental health today. This is what I'm going through. This is what I'm managing. You know, those kind of capacities and conversations.
As you've done screenings, I wonder how much you've heard from people who have come up to you and said, hey, this has helped me sort of deal with my family, or the way that my family also hasn't talked about this. This is now, I'm just, you know, that maybe, does, I wonder if it opens up things for people.
You know, we haven't had a screening where somebody hasn't come up and said, you know, shared a story of their own. At every single screening, at least one person, either in the Q&A afterwards publicly or personally, will come up to me afterwards and just kind of share some similar version of the events of the film. I think people are really eager to have those conversations and to disclose. And I also really hope that the film is really cathartic. It's a cathartic experience for people who have gone through similar challenges.
I'm not going to give away the ending because I want everyone to see it. But I'm curious about, it is a, you know, it does end on a really, I think, hopeful note, your film.
Yeah.
And I wonder, did you intend when you did this story, did you set out that it would be something that would be, was it your goal that this would help sort of create conversations around mental illness? Or was it for you more just a personal, I really want to do this for me?
I mean, it started as a personal journey. I didn't really think that anyone might be interested in this story. But as we got more footage, as I was looking at it, it kind of became larger than just my family. And that's when I realized that there could be some real virtue in sharing this story and creating these conversations. As to the ending, you know, we didn't really know it was going to end that way until it happened. And I remember talking to Gordon Quinn about it, the founder of Cartemwin and kind of the executive producer of the film. And he was really thrilled with that ending because it kind of wraps up a lot of the themes that we've been exploring, you know, throughout the film.
Do you feel like, I think it's interesting because when we talk about in public radio, or especially when it's, you know, we see stats about suicide or conversations about depression, there's always sort of a, let's have a conversation about breaking the stigma around mental illnesses or suicide or depression. Do you feel like art can do that in a way that's probably more effective because it's sort of, I don't know if it's a like kind of a backdoor conversation to...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big reason why I decided to make this as a film and why I decided to become a filmmaker is that, you know, we can, at the end of the day, this is a film about a family, about an immigrant story. And yes, it happens to touch upon some of these other issues. But the hope is that we can, yeah, we can kind of sneak in a discussion about some of these really serious issues in an otherwise, you know, immigrant narrative, a narrative about a son going on this journey. So I think also art and storytelling has a way to embrace complexity in ways that I think it would be really hard to really sit down and look at all of the different social issues that kind of affected my parents and my own story. But in telling this organic narrative, we can kind of weave together a lot of this complexity.
And I want to ask you particularly about the immigrant narrative, about the South Asian narrative in this. I'm thinking about our current Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy. He's also South Asian. And I've heard him talk about this. I've talked to him about this issue of the stigma, especially in Asian families around mental illness. And I'm thinking about even there's like a scene where you in the film where your sister talks about how your dad had this belief that your mom's mental illness was because she was in the U.S. and if they just moved back to India, it would be OK. You know, and there's a lot in there that you could unpack. But I wonder how much of this is, if you think that particularly when we're talking about immigrant communities, particularly when we're talking about Asian American, South Asian families, do you feel like there's even more of a stigma?
In my own experience, I would say yes. I think there are some really unique factors in the South Asian American experience and the Asian American experience mm-hmm. that make talking about mental illness really challenging. One that never crossed my mind until I was making the film was the tradition of arranged marriage and how having a hereditary illness really affects how, you know, people are treated in going into arranged marriages.
Yeah, you talked to your aunt about this, your aunt and uncle.
Yeah. And
she that, just, what does she say? She says, I got a bad deal or something. Well, she just comes right on worst.
She's very, very candid. And I think a big part of that is the arranged marriage. She thought she was going to marry into a pretty solidly middle class business family. And instead, she ends up being the caretaker to a man dealing with schizophrenia. Now, she was an incredible caretaker, and she, you know, they're still together in the film. But it was, you know, there's a reason that it was so silenced, right? There was a, and that was the marriage. And I think, you know, other extended family, you know, they're hesitant to talk about this stuff because they have kids that are, you know, maybe going to have arranged marriages as well, and they're worried about how these illnesses are going to be perceived.
Yeah. Apart from the arranged marriage issue, are there other things that you think, when we think particularly about the Asian American experience? I would agree with you. Yeah. Obviously, being Asian American myself, I think that's also been my experience. Right. Is something that's a little bit more difficult to talk about. And I would say maybe more outside of a, like, maybe it's something you don't talk about outside of your immediate family, mm-hmm. but maybe you would have those conversations within your immediate family.
Outside of an arranged marriage, you know, I think the model minority baggage is still really prevalent and just really just very, very huge. I think there's this expectation, especially among young people, to achieve really, really high, to do really incredible things academically, career-wise. And the other side of that coin is to also make it look almost effortless. I think there's that, you know, that expectation. And so to acknowledge, oh, I'm dealing with depression, or I've got anxiety, or, oh, there are these other things, I think that makes it, that kind of directly contradicts that model minority.
Yeah, it kind of puts a crack in the veneer of, like, we are the successful, hardworking,
exactly,
high achieving.
Yeah,
that's interesting. So what, like, where do you go from here with this? Where you're taking this all over Illinois, you're taking it all over the country. What's kind of your plan with this?
Yeah, so I've been traveling and screening the film since about October. There's just been this great kind of organic groundswell of interest. So I've been screening it at film festivals, at colleges and universities, and also with community organizations. And I'm continuing to do that for the next few months. And it is syndicated on America Reframed, which is a show on WGBH in Boston, and it will be available to be streamed, you know, around that broadcast, which is going to be in May of this year.
Well, this Thursday, folks in Peoria have a chance to see Unbroken Glass. That's the next screening that's happening. We'll tweet out links to the website for the film so you can see when it's coming to your area as well. I know you've got a couple more in Skokie and Chicago in May. I want to thank Dinesh Sabu, who's the filmmaker behind Unbroken Glass. Hey, Dinesh, thanks so much for being with me.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for chatting.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we speak with the Jupiter String Quartet. They'll be performing in Urbana tomorrow night. According to cellist Daniel McDonough, all the pieces in the upcoming program center around the idea of love.
So there's the Dvorak love songs. There's this Janáček Quartet, which is subtitled Intimate Letters, which was inspired by this love that he had in his life. And then there's this Schumann Quartet, which has the famous Clara motive, which was these two notes that he assigned to represent his wife. So there's that thread that brings these pieces together.
They'll give us a sneak peek and have an in-studio performance on tomorrow's program. Speaking of music, word today that Chicago blues legend Lonnie Brooks has passed away at 83. We wanted to end today's program with his iconic Sweet Home Chicago.
Come on, baby, don't you want to go? Come on.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.
To that same old place, Sweet Home Chicago.
one is two, two and two is four. The way that I love you, baby, you are.